Hello and welcome to this edition of Diabetic Health. I'm your host, Eileen Byrne, and this week I'll be reading to you from the online journal diatribe.org as well as diabetesinitiative.org. Our first article comes from the Learning Curve section of Diatribe, entitled Diabetes and Depression, 7 Things to Know and Resources to Help You Take Action. This is by Alexander J. Wolf. Here's a short summary of the article first. Diabetes is far more than A1C, blood glucose values, and insulin doses. It's stress, mental burden, and worry. We were glad to see many talks dedicated to diabetes and mental health issues at ADA this year and have gathered our top 7 takeaways. Learn the stats and signs of distress or depression, talk to your healthcare provider, and take advantage of all the great resources out there. Sometimes diabetes can feel like a total numbers game. What's my A1C? How many carbs are in my meal? What's my blood glucose, and how fast is it rising or dropping? The mental burden of dealing with these questions day in and day out takes a toll. And the reality is that mental health issues, particularly diabetes, distress, and depression, are very real for many patients. We were pleased to see lots of discussion about these topics at the American Diabetes Association conference. Here are our top 7 takeaways about diabetes and mental health. First, diabetes distress is much more common than clinical depression and affects up to 39% of people with type 1 and 35% of people with type 2. This term refers to the expected worries, concerns, or threats associated with diabetes. People should be aware that if they are struggling with depression or distress, these statistics make it clear that they are not alone. Second, the conversation should start early. Parents and healthcare providers are encouraged to educate adolescents with diabetes about the risks of developing mental health issues at an earlier age. As one presenter framed it, the first conversation a parent has with their child about diabetes and mental health should not be when they are in high school and already showing symptoms of depression or distress. Third, mental health screening should be a routine part of diabetes care. According to Dr. Carolyn Thorpe, if physicians could screen their diabetes patients for only one thing, it should be depression. Unfortunately, many healthcare providers are not experienced or trained in mental health issues. Fourth, false positives remain an issue when diagnosing depression. When it comes to mental health screening, first impressions aren't enough. Any initial positive diagnosis for a mental health condition must be followed up with an in-depth screening by a trained mental health professional, particularly given that many first-stage screening processes only involve shortened surveys of mental health diagnostics. A more thorough follow-up is often necessary. Fifth, several therapies exist for coping with depression and diabetes distress. People need to find one that works for them. Problem-solving therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, exercise, mind-body therapy, medications, and more. A mental health professional will know what therapies make sense for a particular person, and finding one that understands life with type 1 or type 2 diabetes is key. Sixth, depression and diabetes distress change over time. While living with diabetes is 24/7, depression or diabetes distress are not. Some patients may initially have these issues and then work to control them, whereas others may start out with no mental health complications and only over time develop them. Some days are worse than other days, some weeks worse than other weeks, and some months worse than other months. Just like diabetes, depression is not the same for everyone. For that reason, mental health screenings and awareness should not be a one-time check, but a routine part of diabetes checkups. And seventh, depression has been linked to poor self-care, poor glycemic control, unemployment, decreased quality of life, and several other negative factors that only make it harder to live with diabetes. In other words, treating depression is equally as important as treating diabetes. If diagnosed with depression or diabetes distress, people should take it seriously and take action immediately. Our next article is entitled, Fighting for a Food Philosophy, What Should I Eat? This is by Carrie Maroney Sparling. What should I eat? This is a question that just tumbles out of the mouths of people with diabetes. Managing diabetes is a constant quest to balance food and sugars, leaving us always wondering, quote, will that meal make me high, unquote? Or, quote, will that food affect my blood sugars the same way it did last time? What should I eat, unquote? With a couple of decades of diabetes under my belt, I've attempted to share of food management tools. I've used the little food scales and pocket-sized measuring cups. I've tried to log every morsel I consume, and I've also tried some structured diets provided by my dietitian at Joslin, only to become bored within a week or so and then return to my old habits. Checking out the recommendations made by health organizations doesn't help much either. Different diabetes sources change their views on food with the tides of studies and newswire releases. Coffee is good. Don't drink coffee. Eat less meat. Get enough iron. Don't eat any carbs. Have some whole wheat bread. Drink milk. Avoid dairy. Watch out for peanut butter. Get more omega-3s. Once your head stops spinning, you realize you're eating nothing but sugar-free popsicles and cat food. It became clear that it wasn't a diabetes diet that I needed, but more of a food philosophy. I needed a mindset that didn't feel so constraining, like the word diet does. And I sure as heck didn't want another restriction in my life. After a few months of careful thought, some experimentation, and a realistic assessment of my expectations, I developed my food philosophy. The philosophy, my husband and I say jokingly, imagining the sound of a sonorous gong after the words are uttered. We take our foolishness very serious in my home. Ingredients of a food philosophy. The philosophy is that a lower carbohydrate, higher protein diet is what works best to keep my blood sugars under control. It seems that eating healthy and taking or attempting to properly calculate the right amount of insulin to cover what I'm consuming is the key to managing my numbers and not constantly berating myself for any perceived slip-ups. But aside from the insulin factor, my husband and I share a very similar diet, eating low-carb, high-protein, and plenty of vegetables. It's easier to follow a food philosophy when you have in-house support. That support can make all the willpower difference. Our collective family philosophy is that eating healthy is good for everyone, not just people with diabetes. And eventually, this mindset becomes a way of life. I don't generally eat a lot of carb-dense foods, but if I'm going for broke and diving into a bowl of pasta, I try to picture the portion sizes in my head. Whenever I see a nutritionist, I ask for a refresher on what a real portion size looks like, because it's easy to forget. Sometimes, when I'm cooking at home, I measure my food and take careful note visually of the serving sizes. That helps me better estimate portions when I'm at a restaurant. I also don't incorporate many of the diabetic foods into my diet. Thanks to the constant stream of information from our food editor at work, I'm leaning towards the perception that making things low carb and low fat removes the carbs and fat but replaces them with chemical substances. I'm doing my best to make as many organic choices as possible. I use sugar substitutes like Splenda, Equal, Stevia in my coffee, but I try to use them in moderation, and I opt for the organic ones when I can. I do choose sugar-free gum, though. Some habits are hard to break, even for the sake of the philosophy. But it's not like I'm sitting around chewing on organic tea tree root and drinking filtered water. I eat, and I eat a lot. I am ridiculously snacky, often found munching on fresh green beans, apples, almonds, walnuts, cheese sticks, and Greek yogurt. For dessert, sugar-free Jell-O, angel food cake, or berries with Cool Whip. But sometimes, a cup of coffee is a good stand-in for a dessert. Either way, every few hours, I'm eating, and it's usually something reasonably healthy. Getting through tough patches. But there are definitely days when following the philosophy isn't so easy. Thankfully, I have some tools at my disposal to help navigate moments when I'm splurging a little. Back in the days of NPH and regular insulin, I avoided foods like pasta sauce, pizza, and high sugar items because insulin just couldn't keep up with those kinds of carby demands. The absorptions and peaks of those insulins weren't as predictable as today's Humalog and Novolog, so my diet was more scheduled and strict than it is now. Today, using my insulin pump and a cartridge of rapid-acting insulin, I'm able to better manage those forbidden foods. Eating high-carb foods like pasta and pizza on Saturdays, a strategy used by my husband and one that I follow, helps me keep my carb indulgences to a minimum, knowing that I can satisfy my cravings on the weekend. And when I do find my face in a bowl of pasta, I make use of the square wave bolus on my mini-med pump. But there are also moments of serious splurging, and at those times, you just have to eat the brownies and deal with the aftermath. If these splurges are few and far between, things are still manageable. The most frustrating thing about food is that certain foods affect me one way on one day, then completely differently on another. It's downright maddening. But it helps to have those handy aforementioned management tools, such as a glucose meter, fast-acting carbs or insulin, and a CGM, to deal with those moments. It also helps to have friends and family who get it. And when all else fails, it's good to just let out a nice loud scream. Everyone's method of managing diabetes is different, and there's no definitive right or wrong way to do it. Diabetes is a uniquely and individually managed condition, so your answer to what should I eat may be different from another person with diabetes. The best way to view food in this conundrum is not as a diet, but a lifestyle. Think about what works best for your life, talk to your doctors, and work toward developing your own philosophy. Here's another article from the Learning Curve section. This was dated September of 2019, and it's by Ursula Biba. Free nutrition counseling covered by Medicare. Have you used this benefit? A rarely used benefit. Medicare covers up to 3 hours of personal nutrition counseling for people with diabetes and/or kidney disease after healthcare professional referral. Studies have found that nutrition counseling leads to improved health and fewer complications, and Medicare covers exactly this type of counseling for people with diabetes or kidney disease. And yet, in 2017, only 7% of eligible people used this benefit. If you are on Medicare, free nutrition counseling is available to you. All you need is a referral from a healthcare professional to a registered dietitian. Free services may include nutrition and lifestyle assessments, individual or group nutrition services, help with lifestyle factors that affect diabetes, including grocery shopping, follow-up visits to track progress, telehealth, phone or video services if you live in a rural area. Medicare will cover 3 hours of dietary counseling the first year the benefit is used and 2 hours of counseling in the following years. A healthcare professional can appeal to Medicare for additional counseling if they think it is medically necessary. You can get more information on that from Medicare's website. Medicare also offers diabetes self-management training, which offers 10 to 12 hours of free diabetes education. This benefit is also underutilized and covers individual and group sessions that include tips for healthy eating, being active, monitoring blood sugar, taking different diabetes drugs, and reducing risks linked to diabetes. If you are on Medicare and interested in learning more about nutrition counseling and diabetes self-management training, share this information with a healthcare professional. Here's another article from the Learning Curve section of Diatribe. Siblings with Diabetes, an Older Sister's Thoughts on Diabetes Care. This is by Sabrina Lynn, Alexander Varon, and Eliza Scholar. What is it like having a sibling with diabetes, and what can someone do to support their sibling with diabetes? 20-year-old Alexandra Varon shares insight on having a younger sister with type 1 diabetes. Quote, "You have to have a team in order to live well with diabetes. That's true whether you're 5, 15, 55, or 85, unquote, says Dr. Jill Weisberg-Benchel, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern University, where she focuses on pediatric chronic disease management. Because diabetes is complicated and challenging, successful care often involves a supportive network of loved ones. We've previously discussed how to navigate a new diabetes diagnosis for your teenager and how to transition care responsibilities from parent to child. But what can siblings do to support their family members with diabetes?" Dr. Weisberg-Benchel said that in a family, it can be difficult to balance responsibilities between parents and children as children grow older and responsibilities shift. Parents' concern for their child's health can be interpreted as criticism from the child's point of view, creating family tension. This is especially true when raising a child with a chronic disease such as diabetes, because parents often help with diabetes management. That's why support from other loved ones, like siblings, can be so important. Dr. Weisberg-Benchel told us that, quote, "almost nobody has studied siblings and the impact of diabetes or any chronic illness on brothers and sisters," unquote. While it's hard to generalize the role that siblings play in different families, today we're sharing one example of just that. We interviewed Alexandra Varon, a student at Santa Clara University, whose younger sister Lily has lived with type 1 diabetes for 8 years. When was Lily diagnosed with diabetes? How did you and your family react to the diagnosis? Lily was diagnosed in kindergarten when she was 5 years old and I was 11 years old. My best friend's mom picked me up from middle school and told me I was going to sleep over at their house because my sister was in the hospital. When my parents told me that my sister had diabetes, I was confused. I had only really heard of type 2 diabetes, and I didn't know the difference between type 1 and type 2. The week before Lily's diagnosis, we had a lot of mango tango juice in our house. Lily drank 6 cups every single day because she was so thirsty and didn't want water. When she got to the hospital, a healthcare provider checked her blood sugar and said, "high," not even a number, just high. How involved are you with Lily's diabetes care? And how involved are your parents? In the beginning, my parents were very hands-on. Lily didn't really have any diabetes responsibilities because she was too young. There are just so many factors that can influence blood sugar. Whenever I'm home from college, I help Lily with diabetes management on more of a friend level. For example, if we're going out to eat, I always try to make sure that the restaurant doesn't only have noodles or high-carb options to make picking food a lot easier for her. Another example is if Lily's continuous glucose monitor signals a low or a high blood sugar and she doesn't respond to the alarm, I'll gently ask her, quote, "what was that?" unquote. This helps remind her to deal with the high or low. I try to remind her of the little things that she might easily forget about, rather than trying to manage her diabetes care myself by dosing insulin for her. My parents had to do that when she was younger, but she doesn't react to it very well, especially now that she is older. What has been the most valuable part of having a sibling with diabetes? What has been the most challenging? I would say it's definitely made me more educated about different medical fields and inspired my interest in health and patient care. It's interesting to see my sister take on so much responsibility at such a young age. And of course, it's hard to always remember her age in relation to what she has to do. Because of this, I would say it has made me more compassionate. It's hard to know how much someone has on his or her plate by just looking at them. You would never know how much responsibility Lily has taken on at such a young age. People with diabetes are very good at hiding their diabetes. Whenever Lily is sick, diabetes management becomes more challenging. If I am sick and throwing up at college, I can just lay in bed and recover. When Lily is vomiting, she usually has to drink liquid carbs instead of dosing insulin to keep her blood sugar in range, because there is a chance that she will throw up what she's eaten and will end up with too many units of insulin in her body, which would lead to low blood sugar. When Lily goes off to college, she might be sick with a fever and have to deal with diabetes on top of that. Is there anything you wish your parents knew about what it's like to have a sibling with diabetes? I would say the whole family aspect of diabetes is really hard. My parents were always kind of helicopter parents. As the older sibling, I understand their side and that they are trying to do everything they can to keep their daughter healthy and in range. But I also understand Lily's perspective, that she is doing everything she can, but still things can go wrong. Or sometimes when she does things incorrectly, things can turn out right. It's the unpredictability of it all. I would say the hardest part is trying to help all of my family members find common ground and understand each other when each of their perspectives makes sense. I've also been the communicator between them. As I've gotten older, my parents have listened to me more and trusted my opinion more. But when I was younger, they didn't really listen to what I had to say. I wish they could have known that often a sibling has a good perspective on the two sides and has the knowledge to know what is happening, in addition to being worried about their sibling. Is there anything you wish your friends knew about what it's like to have a sibling with diabetes? I would say the hardest part for me right now is her friends. I think it will get better when she's older, but for now they don't quite understand what Lily has to go through to manage her diabetes. A lot of times they'll suggest getting smoothies or going out for food. It's fine for Lily to eat smoothies and carbs, but it means she has to dose and deal with added work. Instead, they could go to a Mexican restaurant and Lily could order beans and a salad or something with less carbs. I think they treat her like everyone else, which is good if you're not that close with her, but I feel like her close friends could be more aware and more supportive. Is there anything you wish Lily knew? Everyone is on her side. No one is trying to make her life harder. We're all just trying to navigate the already difficult teenage years. It's hard to maintain target blood sugars during the teenage years, and we're trying to help her keep her blood sugar as low as possible and figure out a good way to balance everything by herself. But also, Lily needs to know that she doesn't have to deal with it all by herself, and she can ask for help. What advice would you give your younger self about supporting Lily? Or what advice would you give other people who have siblings with diabetes? Just try to find the middle ground between being overly protective like parents and being very relaxed about it, acting like the sibling doesn't have diabetes. I feel like I can sometimes be too much of either one. Try to find a way to be on their team without being too much of the extremes. Like Dr. Wiesberg-Benchel reminded us, it's important to realize that everything that's happening is not your sibling's fault. I know that sounds obvious, but if they happen to dose incorrectly or forget something, it's all part of being human. Don't get mad about mistakes. Instead, try to be understanding and think of a solution. What is the next step? How are we going to respond to this? People without diabetes forget things all the time, but it doesn't affect our health because we don't have diabetes. Anything else you have to share? I think moving towards time in range as a measure of diabetes management is such a good idea. I know for Lily, it's so hard to constantly be told your A1C was bad again. It's such an abstract number that you can't really think about on a day-to-day basis. With time in range, you can ask, how can I do my best to be as in range as possible today? And if you mess up, you can learn from that and try again tomorrow. Our next article from diatribe.org is from their new Now Next section, dated June of 2019, Remote Medical Care and Nutrition Guidance for Remission of Type 2 Diabetes, Impressive 2-Year Trial Results. This is by Jimmy McDermott and Peter Rentzepis. Virta's program resulted in reversal of type 2 diabetes in 54% of participants after 2 years. Data showed 10% body weight loss, 0.9% A1C reduction, and reduced need for insulin and diabetes medications. Virta Health provides a, quote, online specialty medical clinic, unquote, with health coaches and physicians who help individuals manage diabetes and possibly put it into remission using daily app-based coaching and individualized carbohydrate restriction based on a very low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet. Virta recently published 2-year outcomes data from a study of the program, which enrolled 262 participants with type 2 diabetes. After 2 years, among the Virta users, the following results were achieved. 54% had achieved diabetes reversal, defined by Virta as an A1C less than 6.5%, and no diabetes medications other than metformin. 18% had achieved partial remission, defined as an A1C less than 6.5% without medications, and 7% had achieved complete diabetes remission, defined as an A1C less than 5.7% without medication. The Virta participants also experienced many other benefits. Average weight loss was 10% of starting body weight with Virta, about 27 pounds, compared to no change in weight among the standard care group. A1C was reduced by 0.9% with Virta, from a starting A1C of 7.7%. Those receiving standard diabetes care experienced an A1C increase of 0.4% from a starting A1C of 7.9%. Significantly fewer Virta users needed diabetes medications. The percentage of Virta participants using a diabetes medication besides metformin dropped from 56% at the start of the study to 27% after 2 years. For the standard care group, this percentage increased from 67% to 79%. Virta users saw an 81% reduction in insulin requirements at 2 years, from 81.9 to 15.5 units per day. The standard care group saw a 13% increase in insulin dose needs, from 96.6 to 109.3 units per day. These highly encouraging results were very similar to Virta's 1-year study results. In addition to the A1C weight loss and insulin use benefits, decreasing carbs dramatically reduced the need for other glucose-lowering medications and therefore may also lower treatment costs. The cost savings for the average insulin user in the study were estimated at nearly $5,000 annually. Several employers and health plans fully cover the cost of the Virta treatment. Based on this data, Virta recently announced its pricing for insurance companies is now 100% based on outcomes. If the user does not get benefit, Virta does not get paid. Those without insurance coverage can use Virta for $370 per month for the first year, plus a $500 initiation fee, and $199 per month for all subsequent years. To offset costs, Virta offers a need-based payment assistance program and is also working with health plans to expand coverage. Low-carb diets are part of a wave of new research looking at putting type 2 diabetes into remission. Low-carb diets are very low-calorie diets, and bariatric surgery are all the most common new approaches.